2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 335, Is Progressive Political Activism Supported by Mormon Theology? A panel discussion featuring John Charles Duffy, James Tobler, Deborah Raffel, Scott Warnick, and Amity Scoville.
Welcome, few though we are, perhaps more will trickle in. This is session, the number is hard to see. This is session 335, Is Progressive Political Activism Supported by Mormon Theology? My name is John Charles Duffy. I'll be moderating this panel discussion. I have been asked to remind everyone that admission to sessions is by name tag or ticket only, so if you have crashed without a name tag or ticket, you will go to hell. I have also been asked to remind people to turn off their cell phones and or pagers, a problem which has begun to emerge this year in particular, as opposed to last year. Let us begin. As I said, my name is John Charles. A little about me and why I am moderating this panel. I'm a lifelong Latter-day Saint. I served a mission in the Dominican Republic about 10 years ago. It was, for me, a life-changing experience in many ways, one of which was that it brought me face-to-face for the first time with the poverty that is the normal reality for most of the people who live on this planet, and did so in a way that was very personal. Third world poverty after my mission was not just shacks flashing by a tourist bus window or anonymous faces on television. It was people that I knew and cared about. When I returned from my mission, I discovered Catholic liberation theology, and as a result of that experience came to see my own faith tradition in a new light and began to feel quite strongly that the call to build Zion includes a call to confront poverty and injustice in our world and work to transform the world in which we live. In 1997, after receiving my master's degree, I returned to the Dominican Republic as an education volunteer in a community development program, which I like to think of as my second mission experience. In early January of this year, I was forwarded an email that had been sent out by a Latter-day Saint who was interested in finding like-minded Latter-day Saints to come together and form an organization of progressive Mormons. That is to say, an organization of progressives from Mormon backgrounds who were interested in engaging with issues of equality and social justice. It is through that email that I ended up meeting James Tobler, who you see sitting the second person there, who is the author of that email and is now credited as the founder of MESSAGE, Mormons for Equality and Social Justice. All the people you see sitting here today are members of that organization. Our panelists are as follows. You see there James. Let me grab my biographical info. James served in the Mexico-Guadalajara mission. He has a BA in U.S. History and another BA in Spanish, both from the University of Utah, and an MS in Labor Studies from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He worked as an intern union organizer in Mexico City for 4 months and was employed as a field organizer with the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America in Philadelphia for over 2 years. He's currently living in Salt Lake City and is trying to build Utah Jobs for Justice, an organization that works with labor rights. Sitting next to him is Deborah Raffel. Deborah is an economics PhD student at the University of Utah. Her focus is healthcare economics in particular. And she has added a note here to her bio that people who are interested in health issues in this country, she recommends a couple of websites, one by the Physicians for a National Health Program and another by the Utah Healthcare Alliance. And she may have more to say about that in her presentation. Sitting closest to me is Scott Warnick. Scott is a native Utahn and is currently practicing law in Salt Lake City with the film Bendiger, Crockett, Peterson, and Casey. He did his undergraduate work at the University of Utah, where he majored in philosophy and political science and attended the University of Minnesota Law School. Scott began working on progressive causes as a student at the U in the Lowell Benyon Community Service Center. After law school, he worked for 2 years at Utah Issues, a nonprofit organization that works to alleviate the causes and the symptoms of poverty. At the very end, we see Amity Scoville. She's finishing a bachelor's degree in community psychology at the University of Utah and recently returned from a mission in California. She's interested in human rights activism and, as I recall, works for the, what's the name of the center?
Birth and Family Place. The freestanding birth center.
The Birth and Family Place, a freestanding birth center here in Salt Lake City. Before I turn the time over to the panelists, let me talk a little bit about MESSAGE itself. MESSAGE stands for Mormons for Equality and Social Justice and emerged in January of this year. Since then, MESSAGE has, well, the mission statement of MESSAGE is, I have too many papers here, I should be more organized. Bad, John Charles. The mission statement of MESSAGE states in part that it is a grassroots organization of Latter-day Saint individuals who are anxiously engaged in working for the gospel values of peace, equality, justice, and wise stewardship of the earth in a spirit of Christ-like charity and concern. We do this, one, by raising awareness in LDS communities of the inequalities and injustices that exist in the world today, two, by actively participating in political processes to resolve these issues, and three, by promoting and engaging in humanitarian service. In practice, what that means is this. MESSAGE participates in rallies. It lobbies legislatures. It lobbies legislators on issues that are important to us. In early February, as in conjunction with the Olympics, a campaign called March for Our Lives came to Salt Lake City to raise awareness of poverty during the Olympics. MESSAGE became involved in that campaign. We took on the task, actually, of organizing an interfaith service for that campaign and later marched with them. We have marched in rallies designed to raise concerns about the war on terror. We have lobbied Orrin Hatch to support welfare reform measures. We have tabled at different kinds of events, Earth Day, May Day, as an event for labor, distributing quote sheets that are designed to highlight teachings in the LDS tradition that speak to issues like workers' rights, gender equity, racism, civil rights, poverty, and wise stewardship of the environment. We have a table down here in the vendors area. We would invite you to come by and check us out and grab some literature. With no more self-promotion, let's turn to our panelists. I've asked each panelist to take 10 minutes to talk about their personal story. How is it that they, as Latter-day Saints, got involved in the issues, the political and social issues that matter to them? We'll give each one about 10 minutes to speak, and then that should leave us with plenty of time for questions and comments. James, yourself, please.
My name is James Tobler, and basically about my own kind of process and coming to where I am now. As John Charles, I served a mission in an impoverished place. I was in Mexico, and a lot of my areas were these towns on the outskirts of a metropolitan area or in these small farmer communities where I did see a lot of poverty. And that was just so different. I mean, it was just very significant for me to see that. And having come from where I came from and then seeing the integrity and the humility and the morality of so many of these people and then just having discussions with them. I know we're not supposed to talk politics on our mission, but you just can't help it so much when people are telling you that different policies that come from the United States affected how the economy develops in many countries, especially someplace like Mexico, which is right next to the United States. And so it was significant for me to come home and see the wealth, and one of the first places I went to after my mission was Las Vegas, and saw the Mercedes Benzes, and I just kind of walked around in a daze for I think quite a few weeks, and then I started going to school at the University of Utah studying history, and kind of started leaning towards like social movement history, you know, women's suffrage, the labor movement, and actually what was also kind of significant to me was the excommunication in 1992 of you know the six individuals in September. That was just significant because I had so much faith in the church to always do the right thing, and then I started seeing these inconsistencies, which was kind of difficult for me to kind of figure out how did it all fit together. And so I really started to do some soul searching about Mormonism and about politics, and it was kind of intertwined for me. And then with my studies, I studied more and more like the labor movement of the 20s and the idealism that went along with that. And it seemed like such a perfect mix, you know, the ideal of solidarity, looking out for one another. You know, an injury to one is an injury to all. And that was just the service, you know, that was the golden rule in action, is what I saw in the labor movement of the 1920s. And then there was a strike out at Hexcel, a plant here in Kearns, and I was with an organization that spent some time at that picket line, and I started walking that picket line with those workers and talking to them. And what had happened is another company had bought Hexcel, and there was a union there. Nevertheless, since they were buying, you know, I'm not sure what the logistics were with the contract, but they were able to cut wages by a third and then basically wipe out their retirement that they'd been working towards. And these are people that have been working there for years and years and years. And it just really stirred my sense of justice. And basically walking that picket line, I decided that was something I wanted to do. I was actually thinking of studying theology. And then I started thinking I wanted to study liberation theology. And then I just thought I'd just go to the whole liberation side of things and study theology on my own time. But what I'd like to talk about quickly is introduce the ideal of eternal progression. What is progress, and what goes into helping people progress in their lives? And without going into the depths of existentialism, I'd like to propose that people are more likely to develop their own capacities, capabilities, and talents when they are empowered to make the decisions which affect their lives. When people are just going to work, they feel like they don't have any kind of say in the political process or any kind of say which affects their lives. I mean, you can see it in people's faces when they're walking to work. There's not a whole lot of thought going into it. They're doing what they have to do. They're putting food on the table. They're coming home. They're working a job or maybe two jobs. They're exhausted. And so this process of empowering people to make decisions in their lives makes people start thinking about things critically, starts raising consciousness, starts making people aware of what's going on around them, of their coworkers, of maybe greater systemic problems in society. And I would argue that this is very much in keeping with the ideal of eternal progression, because it's forcing people to analyze what's going on in their lives, analyze what's going on in politics. And so kind of the premise of what I want to talk about in the next few minutes is that this ideal of eternal progression is very much brought to light when people become active in their communities and active in politics. Of course, we're all familiar with the Chinese proverb, which says it's better to teach someone to fish than to just give someone fish. The logic in that is when you teach someone to fish, they're no longer dependent on someone else. They can go out and develop their own talent in fishing. They can and learn about what it is to fish, maybe develop some of their own strategies in fishing. And I think that's a core gospel principle to me, that people have confidence in their own abilities and can develop their own talents and learn for themselves, you know, right from wrong or whatever that may be. And I would argue that when the political left is at its best is when it empowers people to make the decisions which affect their lives. That doesn't always happen in movements, but it very often does happen in activist circles. People become empowered. Disempowered people become empowered to make decisions which affect their community or affect their place of work or the environment. With that said, I mean, a lot of people be critical, saying a lot of times when you empower people to make decisions, they mess it up or they fall down. You know, it's not an effective way of achieving a goal. because these people a lot of times are uneducated or don't have a capacity to work with different mechanisms that exist in society. And I would argue that it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Because when these people can make these decisions in their lives and get involved in their communities, they're developing. And that's what, to me, that's the essence of the gospel. These people learning about themselves, gaining feelings of self-worth. So even though, political activism is outside the context of church, it's outside the context of religion, I still see development within people's lives, and I'll talk about that right now, actually. as John Charles mentioned, I worked as a union organizer. I worked in Mexico City, which was very interesting, and also in Philadelphia, and also in Western Massachusetts, and spent some time other places. Union organizers, they also often jump around to work on different campaigns. And I saw people develop during these organizing campaigns, and it's an amazing, great thing. For example, a lot of times when we're trying to put together a committee in an organizing drive, you'll see a lot of people that want to bring the union in because they want better wages, they want a safe place to work, they want health care. And these are all very selfish things, it's kind of bread and butter issues. And a lot of people never move outside that vision of what it means to be a union or what it means to be an activist. But a lot of people do break outside of that, and they start to think about their community. They start to think about their coworker. They might be a skilled machinist, but they have, someone else that pushes a broom that's making minimum wage in their shop, and they're willing to fight for that person that's making minimum wage. Or maybe they're willing to fight for the Latino worker that doesn't speak English. And that, to me, is a great thing. I mean, I don't think we can, downplay that. I mean, that is the essence of the gospel in a lot of ways, to start thinking about one another. And that's when I felt that unions and organizing and activism is at its best. Now, I'm kind of talking about this in a working class context, but I've also seen it, in different people that get involved through college campus activism, get involved with, some kind of movement on campus. And once students or, different people get involved in different activism type of activities, I see them start to thinking about, the world, politics, and start really relating to people that work in a sweatshop in Thailand, or relating to, environmental destruction in Brazil, and start seeing. And I think especially in the context of Mormonism, so many of us did serve missions in other countries, and we start to relate to these other people and start to put ourselves in their shoes. And that is what so much of the gospel is about. So my kind of development on this was very much kind of seeing how politics worked, and then starting to hear about Archbishop Romero in El Salvador, who was a Catholic priest. I'm not sure what was, he was the Archbishop of El Salvador. And he was assassinated basically because he was standing up for different human rights issues in El Salvador during a time when human rights abuses were rampant throughout the country. And that's, that's a lot of where liberation theology came out of. And so that's been significant to me, and I started thinking about Mormonism in that context. And really, we have such a rich theology and history here in Salt Lake City, even, that encourages this type of involvement in our communities and encourages activism. So I'd just like to read some things. Of course, we could all talk about, you know, things that happen in Mormon history that maybe aren't, you know, that show that there's been different prominent Mormons that haven't stood for labor rights or that haven't stood up for the disempowered. But I think what we're doing in our organization is, you know, that stuff is there, but what we want to do is bring to light this other type of theology, these other statements, this other history we have, which very much it stands for human rights, for to end poverty and these type of things. Just as far as like labor is concerned, J. Reuben Clark, who was considered a conservative at the time, but had a great statement on organized labor. He said, "I have not approved and do not approve of capital's weapons, the blacklist, lockouts, and grinding out the maximum of returns for the minimum of wage outlay, even the imposition of starvation wages that too often have been capital's means of dealing with labor in the past. These have worked great injustices that must not be repeated." I'd like to read this quote by Brigham Young. I guess, how much more time do I have? We did talk about that a little bit.
Well, we can go back to that.
We can go back to that. Basically, our mission is to get involved in the communities, and you kind of use Mormon theology as justification for our involvement in the communities. Okay, kind of to jump back to what I was saying, just a little bit. You know, we all know about the United Order, I assume. That ideal that we could all live in this kind of utopian society and work together to not have poverty among us and be involved in our communities and you know, cooperatives and et cetera, with that in mind, I want to read the statement by Brigham Young. "I have looked upon the community of Latter-day Saints in vision and beheld them organized as one great family of heaven, each person performing his several duties in his line of industry, working for the good of the whole more than for individual aggrandizement." I mean, that ideal of working for the good of the whole rather than just for yourself is something I think we need to develop in our society, develop in our places of work. Again, this idea that an injury to one is an injury to all. And also, you know, some scripture justification. I kind of like this scripture because it is, I think, so related to organized labor. It's D&C 126, 4 and 5. And basically, the revelation is kind of talking to some workers who are building a house. And it says, "Behold, verily I say unto you, let my servants," then it goes on to list the names of the workers, "organize themselves, and appoint one of them to be a president over their quorum for the purpose of the building of that house. And they shall form a constitution whereby they may receive stock for the building of that house." So here is, you know, outside the context of the United Order, this is back in Nauvoo, you know, here the Lord is actually saying, form a quorum, you know, form a union, if you will, for building a house. And no one's going to profit themselves. The profit is going to be distributed among you. And you know, maybe that's something we should start thinking more about as Latter-day Saints. Maybe we should start thinking about redistribution of wealth and ending poverty and being organized in our places of work. So with that, I will wrap up. Just like to say, Brigham Young, at the first union meeting in Utah, Brigham Young was present at the printers union meeting and gave an opening prayer. He established a laborers union in St. George in the 1870s, which was, you know, basically you had to be a member of the church to belong, which is kind of exclusionary, but, you know, this is one of the things that worked for them. And so I'm going to wrap that up, and we can talk about it more later in the discussion section.
My name is Deborah Rathall, and wow, I agree with so much of what James said, and with so much of his process was similar. Unfortunately, I didn't go on a mission. Otherwise, I might have come about it sooner and more cleanly. My process began by looking at other religions' traditions of coming at social activism. And I've been really inspired by Dorothy Day, who was a Catholic worker. She started the Catholic Workers Movement, and by Martin Luther King, of course, and Gandhi, and the Quakers. The Quakers impressed me because they were willing to do something about what they saw as the roots of the problem. For instance, during the times of slavery, they refused, some of them, to wear cotton, and they refused, some of them, to use sugar because the slaves were involved in the production of sugar and cotton. And that impressed me. I would like to read from a letter that Martin Luther King wrote. And this has really inspired my coming at social activism from the inspiration of Christ's life. This is from his letter from a Birmingham jail. "I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Rather, I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into the creative outlets of direct action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was not Jesus an extremist for love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. We will be extremists for love. Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice, or for the extension of injustice or justice? Jesus Christ was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the nation and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. Few members of the group of oppressors can understand the deep groans and passionate yearnings of the oppressed, and still fewer have the vision to see that injustice must be rooted out by strong, persistent, and determined action." He says, "I'm thankful that some of us have grasped the meaning of the social revolution and committed themselves to it. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men and women willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of social stagnation. We must use time creatively in the knowledge that the time is always right to do right. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy, to lift our national policy from the quicksand of injustice to the rock solid of human dignity." To me, that is so beautiful. And I agree with Thich Nhat Hanh. He's a Vietnamese who has studied the life of Christ. He says, "I think it's very important to look deeply into every act and every teaching of Jesus during his lifetime and to use this as a model for our own practice. Jesus lived exactly as he taught, so studying the life of Jesus is crucial to understanding his teaching. The most basic teaching of Jesus is his life. When we read the Bible, we see Jesus' tremendous courage in trying to transform the life of society." And I, of course, have been interested in looking at the roots of the problem and seeing how they're all interconnected, so it's been hard to choose one, to choose something to focus on. But a few years ago, I decided that healthcare was something that really presents a problem for people, working people, poor people, even those of us who have money. So I want to read some statistics about healthcare just to present the scope of the problem. $13.9 million children are uninsured in the U.S., and 42.5 million people, that's 15.5% of people, are without health insurance. And you'll be surprised to know that about a little less than half of those that are uninsured are full-time workers. And 36% of people stay at jobs that they don't want just to keep their health benefits. The numbers in Utah are even more startling. Of the 300,000 uninsured, 80% work full-time, or more than full-time. That's startling. And the problem is that most of people who are insured are not insured adequately. So this presents a reality in which people put off getting health care until things are very serious. And so people in America, we live with a lot of worry. And it seems to me that it would be a wonderful thing if we could free families who are struggling with this, facing even the most basic health care needs, to focus on other things if they didn't have to worry for their lives and the lives of their families, family members. So even besides these troubling statistics, our healthcare system itself is failing us. We have a situation here in the U.S. where the infant mortality for blacks is twice that of whites. And in other countries like Sweden, there isn't that kind of disparity between race. And infant mortality in the U.S. is similar to that of some developing nations like Singapore, which is troubling too. Health care costs are rising. They've been rising at about 10% for the last few years, and even that number is increasing. It's expected to go up to about 11 or 12% in the next year. And why are costs rising? That's because about 30% of medical payments goes toward overhead to companies and also toward profits. And the healthcare industry is one of the most profitable industries of any, and I would really like to see a system that does away with those overhead costs. I have some more statistics here. Maybe a few more. Okay. Well, for starters, the U.S. spends also much more per capita on health care and covers fewer people than any other Western nation. We spend twice as much as Canada, which provides health care from cradle to grave for every person living in Canada. Okay, so here's an idea for reducing costs. Blue Cross in Massachusetts, a private insurance company, employs more people to administer coverage for 2.5 million in New England than are employed in all of Canada, which covers everyone, to administer coverage for everyone, 27 million people as compared with 2.5 million. So there are ways to make this happen, and there are ways to do it without paying a cent more as a nation. So this is exciting news. We, Message, have just passed a resolution concerning healthcare reform. And I would invite all of you who are interested in learning more about this to visit the PNHP website, Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. And they have worked out a plan for doing this that even covers training the 1.5 million healthcare insurance industry workers, retraining them for jobs. So it's very comprehensive, very exciting. Okay, wrap up. So we have resolved message. We just passed this resolution. All Utahns should receive financial support for medically necessary healthcare services. Utahns should be free to choose among all physicians licensed to practice medicine in Utah. No increase in revenue through either out-of-pocket or tax payments is required to provide universal healthcare services to Utahns. Administrative overhead for financing healthcare services should be held below 5%. Personal medical services should be integrated with public health services and programs, maximizing the effectiveness of preventive programs and services. And all revenues for health services in Utah, whether of federal, state, or private origin, should be combined together and should be managed in a manner responsive to the public. Well, I want to point out that early members of the Relief Society have taken things in their own hands with regard to health care, and this was exciting for me to discover. The Autonomous Relief Society sent women to the East to train as midwives, nurses, and doctors. And in the 20s, the Relief Society used federal matching funds to distribute literature, do research in healthcare clinics, and assist in performing physical examinations. 17 states established maternity health centers, and virtually all wards developed maternity closets where they distributed supplies, bandages, instruments, and clothing to mothers at the time of birth. And the net effect of that was a substantial reduction in maternal and infant mortality. So we have a long tradition, even in the area of healthcare, providing for the needs of our people. And we have the means and the conscience to provide for every person, I would say, at this point, too. I'm heartened by these endeavors, and I'm heartened by the tradition of civic concern and responsibility cultivated by our Latter-day Saint tradition. So, thanks for your time, and please see me if you'd like some more information about the state of our healthcare crisis.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about the issue of poverty. This is a very important issue to me. For the last 10 years or so, I've been working to a greater or lesser extent on the issue of poverty. I think it's one of the most pressing problems in our world, but it's also an uncomfortable, to some extent, topic to discuss because I'm always humbled by what I believe is the spiritual obligation that we have to try to solve this very complicated, very difficult problem. But from my reading of the scriptures, it is one of our most important challenges is to work on issues of poverty. And I believe that our spiritual growth is limited individually and as a spiritual community to the extent that we do not meet the needs of the poor. I grew up thinking that this was very important. My mother's from Scotland, and so because of that, I'm a member of the Macmillan clan, which is a Scottish family, and our motto, and I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing this right, it's Latin, and I don't understand Latin. It was Miseries Sucre Disco, which means I learn to succor the distressed. And so from a very young age, my mom told me that this was very important. This is something that Macmillans do. We work to try to relieve people who are suffering. Growing up, I really didn't like this motto at all because some of the other Scottish families had mottos like to conquer or die, or I am fierce with the fierce. And I was pretty convinced that my ancestors were the wimps of the Highlands. But as I've grown older, I've really learned to appreciate this legacy. And I find myself turning to that motto and to try to remind myself of my spiritual obligations. I think if you asked any Latter-day Saint, is it important for us to try to help the poor I think everyone would probably say yes. I think it's very clear. The scriptures are replete with examples of prophets, of Christ, of leaders talking about the importance of helping the poor. But I think that there are a few myths that persist in the LDS community, and I'd like to talk about those. Myth number one, we should definitely do what we can, but Jesus said the poor will be with us always. Unfortunately, Christ did say this. Christ did say that the poor will always be with you. Unfortunately, I think that this has, probably even for myself, has become an excuse for doing very little, or worse, to accept the status quo. But I think I've gone back to Matthew and John, because that story is contained in both books, to look at the context of why Christ said that. Christ was talking specifically to Judas. He had been anointed with oil, and Judas thought, why don't we take this oil, sell it, and get money and give it to the poor? And Christ said, well, that you don't understand. First of all, the woman that anointed him, he saw it as a preparation for his death. But also, he told Judas that the poor will always be among you. But I think if we think about it, it's hard to reconcile that with the importance in the scriptures of establishing Zion. One of the important characteristics of Zion is that there are no poor among the inhabitants of Zion. So certainly, it must be possible to eliminate poverty in certain communities. So as I've thought about it, the way I understand and reconcile those scriptures is I think that Christ was talking to his apostles specifically, that there will be many, many challenges they'll always have to face with the poor. But two, I think that even if we can establish a Zion, which I think we should all be striving for, that will eliminate poverty, there will still be accidents, there will still be floods, there will still be people that fall in hard times, there will be health crises that come to people. There will always be people that will be in need, and we will always need to be prepared to help meet that need. But I don't think that Christ ever suggested that by saying that the poor will always be among us, that that's an excuse to accept poverty in our communities. Myth number two, I pay tithing and fast offerings, so I have fulfilled my obligation. I feel this way a lot. And one thing I'd like to say is those are very, very important programs that require a lot of sacrifice, and I think they do much, much good. But again, as I look at statements by LDS church leaders, as I look at the scriptures, I think that the obligation goes beyond that, I'm quite certain. First of all, those programs don't satisfy the needs of the poor, obviously. There's still a lot of poor, even in Salt Lake, where we have a lot of LDS members with making many contributions, so I think it goes beyond that. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go over some of the specific statements of church leaders, but I'd really encourage all of you to go by the message table that's in a room over here, in the corner. Do we have a... I'm sorry?
It's at the end of the hall.
At the end of the hall, where we have a number of position statements, where we have quotes, papers on various subjects that we've talked about today, with quotes by church leaders. And there are some great quotes here about the importance of working on poverty and actually going beyond our church obligations to try to relieve the suffering of those living in poverty. But certainly I think the way I think about this is I could not in good conscience go to the Lord and say, I've paid my tithing, I've paid my fast offerings, I've satisfied my obligation to serving you. And Christ did teach us that in serving to serve him, we should serve others. So I think that the obligation goes a little bit beyond that. And one way I like to think about that actually comes to... is addressed by what I find is myth number three. Service to the poor is best done on an individual basis in direct humanitarian service. Although I think this is true in some ways, I think that we need to go beyond this. I used to believe that helping the poor was going to the soup kitchen, and helping there, making contributions for. But as I had a lot of fantastic experiences at the University of Utah as a member and leader in the Lowell Benyon Community Service Center, And as I worked for a couple years at Utah Issues, which worked specifically on poverty, I think I came to look at poverty slightly different, and actually it helped me understand this family motto I had a little bit better. The family motto, again, was I learned to succor the distressed. And I never really thought about the word learn there. And I thought that was kind of interesting. Why do you have to learn to do this? Isn't this just something that's obvious? You go out, you give money, you help where you can. But I think that there is an incredible amount of learning that needs to take place for us to effectively eliminate poverty. Because I think that this is it's a much broader issue than a lack of need. Poverty is reinforced oftentimes by our institutional structures, our economic and political processes. And I think a true remedy for the issue of poverty will require us to rethink a lot of our institutions, a lot of our processes, to try to create a community and a system that helps people bring people out of poverty instead of creating stumbling blocks and obstacles to getting out of poverty. Okay. So one statement that I would like to read about this is from the Proclamation on the Economy. This is fantastic reading. I'm only going to read a section, but I encourage you to go to the Message website. The Message website is mesj.org, where we have this entire proclamation. This is from 1875, written by Brigham Young, and it was signed by his counselors and the Quorum of the Twelve. He said, in this statement, it says, one of the great evils with which our own nation is menaced at the present time is the wonderful growth of wealth in the hands of comparatively few individuals. The very liberties for which our fathers contended so steadfastly and courageously, and which they bequeathed to us as a priceless legacy, are endangered by the monstrous power which this accumulation of wealth gives to a few individuals and a few powerful corporations. By its seductive influence, results are accomplished which, were it equally distributed, would be impossible under our form of government. It threatens to give shape to the legislation, both state and national, of the entire country. If this evil should not be checked and measures not taken to prevent the continued enormous growth of riches among the class already rich and the painful increase of destitution and want among the poor, the nation is likely to be overtaken by disaster. For according to history, such a tendency among nations once powerful was the sure precursor of ruin. I think it's amazing how true this statement still is today, maybe even more so today. And I think really to solve this issue, we do need to look at these sorts of changes. And that's one of the things I love about Message and being a part of this organization, is it creates a vehicle for us to start looking at some of these broader issues of poverty. Because I think the solution to poverty really is going to take both the direct personal interaction and the direct service, but it's also going to take political change to really solve this issue. But I think that we have a spiritual obligation to do this. I would like to conclude with a prayer by Marion Wright Edelman, who is the director of the Children's Defense Fund. And I think this, more than anything else, sums up what I would like to say. God, forgive our rich nation where our babies die of cold quite legally. And God, forgive our rich nation where small children suffer from hunger quite legally. God, forgive our rich nation where toddlers and school children die from guns quite legally. God, forgive our rich nation that lets children be the poorest group of citizens quite legally. God, forgive our rich nation that lets the rich continue to get more at the expense of the poor quite legally. O God, forgive our rich nation, which thinks security rests in missiles rather than in mothers, and in bombs rather than in babies. God, forgive our rich nation for not giving to you sufficient thanks by giving to others their daily bread. God, help us to never confuse what is quite legal and what is just and right in your sight.
I'd first like to really thank all of you for being here. I think that the opportunities that we have to speak out on issues that are really important are going to become more and more common, and that as more people see themselves in a position where they can also open their mouths is really the key to the issue of message. I've been really excited to be involved with this group. I got back from a mission in California, in San Fernando, last February. And as soon as I heard they were around, I've pretty much been around ever since, too. And my entire life, I've really been focused on service, but the way that I look at it has changed a lot. And I know that there's so much that we can do to help other people. And I was thinking a little bit last night about the word advocacy. What does it mean to be an advocate? And in the dictionary, it says that an advocate is someone who pleads another's cause, someone who can step in and speak up, perhaps when someone else is not able. And in the church, we so often recognize that huge position that Jesus Christ has in our lives as being an advocate to the Father, standing up for us and defending us. And I really, I think that this advocacy that I'm interested in is a little bit different from the common, you know, these, there are poor people and they have problems and they need us to stand up and speak for them and be their advocates. I believe that the real way to make social change is to empower people to plead their own cause, to put people in a position where they feel like they can speak for themselves, because who knows better how hard it is to be hungry than people who don't have any food? Who knows better how difficult it is to survive day by day than people who don't have a job? And a lot of these ideas have really hit home to me, and I really appreciated Scott's remarks on kind of some of the myths that we have about helping the poor. And I am not an intellectual at all. I do not really understand the way the political system works. It's something that I'm learning out of necessity, because I know that real social change, you have to understand to some extent the way that stuff works, but I don't really get it most of the time. And I think that lack of knowledge is what really makes us feel powerless. That many members of the LDS Church are not more involved because, well, A, politics is such a taboo, and they figure, you know, if the church doesn't take an official stand on a certain position, that obviously they don't need to or shouldn't do that. But I think that every person has the ability to recognize truth. We have the Spirit. It tells us what's right and what's wrong. We can recognize when something is not just, and we don't need someone else to stand up and say, you know, this whole deal where people aren't getting the health care they need, that's not right. See what you can do about it. So often we wait for other people to tell us how to do it, when to do it, why to do it, when each of us in ourselves react every day to all of these awful things that are happening and yet feel basically disempowered to do anything about it. And I see the LDS community as this giant untapped resource. I've seen, as we've talked to people and said, yeah, we're Mormons for Equality and Social Justice, we just started, and people are so excited. Other community groups say, wow, you know, it's about time that the Mormons got involved with something here in the state. And there really is this view that we're all just sitting in our homes and in our wards and aren't really paying attention to the issues that surround us. And I believe that we have a real moral obligation to get involved with that. Another thing that I think really goes against the political activism trying to change things is the concept that Scott talked a little bit about building the kingdom, building Zion, that there really, someday there will be this place and there won't be any poverty and it will be beautiful and wonderful. And so we say, well, the millennium's coming. You know, Christ will come back and all of these problems will be fixed, and I'll just wait till that happens. And we really do have the responsibility to work to get our society more in that spot, that just waiting for that to happen and getting caught up in the details of our lives, whether or not our children have brand-named jeans to wear to school, then really looking at the issues that are making basic survival difficult for so many because they lack basic human rights. I know that people should have food. I know that people should be able to have access to medical care. Everybody should have a house. And those are things that they just don't have. A lot of political issues are complicated. A lot of them are sort of taboo. We don't want to talk about them. We don't want to get into thinking about the implications. And message is something that has helped me see that there really is a way to open our minds and to become active in something we believe in. And I also know that there are certain issues that are open to everyone that we can all recognize are good, and they don't have to be complicated. I just want to finish up talking very briefly. I just got back the day before yesterday from a conference in Minneapolis. I went out there and met with some folks from the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and their movement. They're the ones that organized the March for Our Lives. That, who was it who talked about that? John Charles. I know your name, I just didn't know who said it. But they organized that, and they're organizing a national movement to end poverty in the United States. And you hear that and you're like, yeah, right, can't end poverty in the United States. But what I really love about their movement is called the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, and I swear it took me 3 weeks just to learn what the acronym stood for, so you don't really need to work too hard on remembering it. But the basis is this, that we don't go into a community and say, oh, this and this and this is wrong, and we're going to start a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're going to get grants and solve this for you. But it's going into a community and empowering the poor people who live there to stand up and to have a voice. It's to find people who can become leaders in that community, and we need everyone's help. We need the students, we need all of the religious groups. It's about education, because the poor have become invisible in the United States. They're statistics, they're things that we don't even really see on the news. There was a story about that they shared about a train station or a metro station somewhere. Maybe it was a subway. I don't remember. But the point was that on the same day in this train station, a dog had died, a maintenance worker had been killed, had died, and a homeless man had died. In the weeks that followed, they received 300 calls concerning the dog. They received one concerning the maintenance worker, and they didn't hear anything at all about the homeless man. And I think that shows a lot the way society is shifting, that poverty has become so invisible, and we each do have this responsibility that when we recognize something as being unjust, we need to find out the ways that we can work to change it.
We have a half hour left for questions and comments from the audience. For the sake of the tape, please go ahead and come forward, speak at the mic. You can direct a question to one or all of the panelists. So we open it up to you. We're eager to hear from you.
Go for it. Okay, I'm not sure how to phrase this question. How do you... We have a state that is undeniably conservative and follows republicanism and conservatism and the leaders of the LDS Church. How do you take a group like yours, which I think is very important, and sell it to this majority? Because I live in Provo, and I worked as a VISTA volunteer last year for AmeriCorps, which is, you probably know what they do. It's to fight the war on poverty, and it was started by Johnson. And it's seen as, everything that is seen as just or equal or a war on poverty is seen as very liberal. And that's a bad thing in this state. So how do we sell it without losing the... I know you've probably been asked this question before, but you know, without hitting the wall where everyone says, you're just liberals, and you, you know, and I'm not interested. So how do we do that? Because I can't figure out why more LDS members aren't involved in ridding, you know, our cities and our neighbors. I mean, I live in a very poor neighborhood by choice. And it's depressing and it's sad sometimes, but I'm also invigorated by it. And I hit that wall all the time where it's like, well, what do you think you're doing? You're just a Democrat and you're a liberal and you were a Vista and you're in all the wrong programs. So whoever wants to answer that long question, please.
You know, what's really interesting is as new people kind of come to the group and they sort of say, you know, well, we ask them how they heard about us and why they came. They're like, well, you know, with the political climate as it is, and we thought, and we all say, you're looking for a group of open-minded Mormons, aren't you? And they all say, yeah, that's what it is. Very good question, and that's an extremely good point, that there is this huge conception, and there are indeed many members of the LDS Church who are seen as very conservative, who have been for generations, who think that if you're a Democrat, you somehow don't fit into the church or of any other party, you know, the Green Party, Labor Party, what have you. And what I have seen as I've talked to people, individuals, is that everyone to some degree is concerned about poverty. And a lot of it has to do with education and giving people opportunities to really see the way that that they act politically has an effect on society. And as I've spoken to people, I would say a lot more often than someone saying, yeah, well, you know, I'm a Republican. And granted, I don't live in Provo, as long as we're going with the stereotypes. But there are people who want to make a difference. And when we give them some sort of way to do it and tell them, you don't need to be an expert to participate in the political process, that's when people are really able to come forward and to do that. And I've heard people say, you know, I always wanted to, but I didn't know how to get involved. And we're kind of like a support group that way too, you know? You can do it. We're doing it. And you don't have to feel like it's just you against the whole world, which I think is very often how liberal LDS people feel. They're the only ones, you know? You're the only one. You're in a closet and you're surrounded by this sea of people who are against you, but I think a lot more of that has to do with our perception than really how it is. And people have been very open and very positive responding to our group. So if you want to start a chapter of Message in Provo, talk to us. There are some people down there who are interested. That goes for any part of the state or country. So I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Yes, I'd like to respond as well, because I think that is a fantastic question, and I think it's really goes to the reason that, at least from my perspective, why this organization is important. I think progressives have been losing the war of ideas in Utah, maybe even nationally to some extent. And that's what we're trying to respond to. I mean, we are nonpartisan, so we don't espouse any specific political party, as far as I know. And so, I mean, Republicans, anyone would be welcome, and I think that the ideas that we are trying to share, we believe should be embraced by people of all political persuasions. Certainly people will come from different backgrounds and maybe contribute to the conversation differently, but I think we would like to try to get everyone on the same page, at least to say that these are important issues that we need to address. And I think we're starting to try to position ourselves that way by having statements to justify our position from an LDS perspective, to say you can be good LDS, and not only good LDS, but in line with the teachings of prophets and church leaders and work on these issues. So I think what we need to do is we need to start engaging in the battle of ideas, not necessarily from an adversarial perspective, but by saying that we would like to talk about this issue too, and we come from similar cultural backgrounds, and these are our ideas. I also wish, you know, this proclamation on the economy, which I'd never even heard about until I got involved in this group, is fantastic. And it's interesting because a lot of LDS families right now have, like, the proclamation on the family framed and in their house. And I think this should be framed and in every LDS family's home because I think it does suggest that there are these sorts of progressive issues that I agree with you, I think have been left as considered kind of liberal. We don't need to deal with that. But we need to try to help connect people's religious beliefs with these ideas and help them embrace them. And I think to do that, we do need to kind of engage in this war of ideas, writing letters to the editor, which I think we're going to start doing, talking about these issues more and more, because I think that there are a lot of members of the church that consider themselves conservative that will embrace these eventually.
A final thought on this issue, the question of selling the organization. The word progressive, the word liberal, is obviously very problematic when you're in a conservative environment. And we made a decision early on not to call the organization the Progressive Mormon Congress, which had been an idea floating around at the beginning. In fact, our email address is still progressivemormoncongress@yahoo.com. We need to get that changed. But we deliberately avoided using those terms in the name precisely because we don't want to immediately turn off people who might actually find that, you know, the causes that we're working for do resonate with them but would be turned off by the L word or the P word. We've been pretty free with it here because we figure it's Sunstone, so we felt safer. A question there. Do you want to come forward and take the mic?
I'm very curious, having attended Sunstone for a number of years, we've got 12 people here. This should be the hotbed of activism in the historical, and what I would like to hear, I don't have a question to the panel, I would like each of the people here to say what their main question or interest is, and why. I just came from a panel of 100 about peace in the Middle East. Why in this environment your friends aren't with you now? Because I think that will be more indicative. The core group always get things done. And the old tradition of when two meet in my name, that is still good, is very applicable and very praiseworthy. But I ask, where are your friends? Why aren't they here with you now? And what are you most interested in? I think it would help the panel and help everyone what is happening. And if anyone would be interested in that, I think we could then decide where to go and how to get there. Because I respect your beginnings and start, but I am frustrated because in one of the most potential for growth environments, we only have 12 people. I just came from 100, and there's only 12 here. And I think part of it's this room shift. Mormons are basically lazy, and that may be an explanation, but I suggest that as an experiment to try if people are interested.
Well, one thing to consider for this perspective is that the panel in the Middle East, which I also attended, had a very large name, you know, a big name person speaking, Bonner Ritchie, which I'm sure was a major draw. We are nobodies. No one knows who we are. Though we do get a lot of people, whenever we table, we get a lot of people who take literature. We get a lot of people who sign up for our email list, you know, and then they kind of lurk. You know, you're right. I mean, the core of people who actually come to meetings and go to rallies and write letters and so on is much smaller, which is frustrating. But there are a lot of people kind of lurking, checking us out, not quite sure what to make of us yet, not sure if we're going to, you know, still be around, not quite sure if they want to necessarily affiliate with us, not quite sure where we're coming from politically. So that is just a problem that I'm sure will work itself out over time.
You're also up against a lot of big
names. Well, yeah, that's true, too. The comment was, we may be attended by more people who would be interested in buying the tape. And I would hope that, too. Yes.
Other comments, please? Questions?
I'm lurking. I'm from Oregon at the moment. I have 27 years of teaching environmental science, biological and chemical science at the college level. And I'm very scared for you because there were numerous occasions when I felt my temple recommend was on the line because I taught topics that are taboo. Even caring for the environment is taboo in some of the wards and branches I've been in. And of course, if I get into population control or any of those issues, it's out of here. And if I dare to mention evolution, then it's totally out of here. And so I'm looking to see if you can, it sounds like you're trying to find a moderate stance here, which I applaud, and I would like to help you, but I'm afraid I'm too radical to be of much use. Maybe I could edit a paper or something, you know, without mentioning too much. But I have suffered so much myself being in that arena, as has my husband, who has a PhD in science too. It's a liberal viewpoint, and we run up against the prejudice against the liberal viewpoint a lot. But you're young, you got that going for you, you're idealistic, and I think other people are lurking and watching and picking up your literature. And if they aren't here today, like my husband's at another session, but he'll read the literature I picked up. And so there are other people working behind the scenes.
We do struggle a lot with moderating ourselves in our meetings, and we're very careful and conscious about what we decide to work on and how we decide to say things. And it's been a wonderful process for us and makes us realize how possible it is for us to be a bridge and welcome people into the process. And as we've tabled on campus, it's interesting to see that for the people even younger than us, they are very concerned about the environment. And there is a consciousness that's blossoming. So that is... there's movement, and that's hard to ignore. As far as relating to conservatives, political conservatives in the state, it's getting harder and harder to ignore the fact that our lives are intertwined, and that with poverty comes things like discontent and violence, and you're more likely to get hit by a stray bullet in your neighborhood. These kinds of things might speak to people's hearts. But also, research in the area of health has shown that even if you have unlimited means for paying for health care, if you live in an impoverished area, you are more likely to die of your ailments. So there is some evidence that you can pepper your conversation with that might help people come to an understanding. But there's no denying that our lives are completely intertwined.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to a couple of things briefly. When the group was first developing, there was a lot of discussion around, would we ever take a position that was maybe not quite in line with church doctrine, and when we discussed that, we thought it would be best that there's enough out there that we can do just around poverty and the environment. And I know we're walking a fine line, but there's so much out there we can do that is in keeping with church doctrine and teachings of prophets and church leaders without stepping on any toes, that's really the angle we're approaching it on. And On our cards, you know, we ask everybody that joins our organization to sign one of these cards. And on the back of it, it says, "I understand that message is not a forum for criticizing the doctrines or policies of the LDS Church, and that message does not adopt positions or on social or political issues which contradict official positions of the church. And so we're really trying to be careful. I'm not saying we're not going to run into problems, but we really do believe, I mean, one of the justifications for this, for organizing this organization is, what was it, 4 years ago when President Hinckley got up and said, you know, get involved in your communities as Latter-day Saints, as like-minded individuals, get together and do good in your communities. And that's kind of our moral justification, if you know, and we really do want to use the language of the church. We want to use quotes from Ezra Taft Benson or Howard W. Hunter or James E. Talmage, whatever we can get, you know, and use this language of the Mormon community, and so we can appeal to a wide variety of political beliefs, and yeah, we're a progressive organization. I mean, our shirts say "Choose the Left," and we've in some ways drawn a line. This is where we stand. But on the other hand, a lot of people, I think, once they get involved in our group, will see that we just, you know, we care about people and want to improve the situation. And I think Mormonism gets caught in this paradigm of really working towards and ending poverty for the members of the church, and we become kind of isolated. And what our group wants to do is, like, look, we're all brothers and sisters, not just brothers and sisters in the church. One thing I love about being involved in unions is it's not confusing to me when I get up to speak. I address everyone as brother and sister also. So I do that in the ward. I do that in union meetings. And in reality, because of our beliefs, we're all brothers and sisters, and we need to start thinking about poverty and these issues, you know, outside of the context of members in our congregation. What is our next event? What is the frequency of what we do is the question. Yeah, we have monthly meetings, sometimes more than monthly. The next one is on the 29th of August at 7 p.m. at the University of Utah in the Union Building at the foyer there. If you want to go, we have an email list, which we encourage everyone to sign up for. And if you're local, we encourage you to come to meetings, and we are going to be doing something in Utah County. Also, right there is a petition to Mayor Anderson, which we have got on board on this campaign, which requires the city to give preference to contractors or to businesses that come to the city that pay a living wage and provide health insurance. So there's something you can do right today. Sign up a petition. But you know, we have ongoing campaigns. Amity could tell more about it. But this, the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign is doing a bus tour, and I believe they're coming to Salt Lake.
They are. They'll be here November 16th, I believe.
So on November 16th, we're going to be welcoming this bus tour, which I believe its purpose is to raise awareness of poverty in the country and start bringing these issues to different communities. Yeah, if everybody brought two friends to the next event, we'd have a great meeting. Yeah. Yeah, I think part of, you know, I was a little disappointed that more people didn't come, but you know, we're still so new to people and they don't know what's going on, but we are. Every time we have a meeting, there's new people at the meeting.
I'm from San Francisco. Come speak in the mic. I'm from San Francisco, so you're kind of preaching to the choir. To me, this is pretty mild. My kids are both Cal Berkeley graduates. My daughter in environmental science. I'd really like to introduce her to you. She's been she doesn't find many guys in the church to date, because she has worked in three Latin American countries in a program called Amigos de las Americas, which I'd like to familiarize you with if you would like. My husband's the East Bay chapter president and on the International Board of Directors. But this experience in working in the outback of Latin America has given her a worldview that is very different from most Mormons. And as I say, she can't find anybody to date in the church, because they're all these people that have been in what I call the Mormon lockstep life path, and they don't think about other people very much or other places. They don't speak any other language unless they went on a mission. They don't go into foreign countries unless they go on a mission. They don't seem to have this broader view. I'd like to know about the environmental problems that you're running into in Utah. I mean, I've I hear that recycling isn't really big here. I mean, we even recycle our garbage into our compost heap because my daughter has taught us how to do this. So tell me what you're running into in the way of problems with making people environmentally aware here.
Yeah, unfortunately, our resident environmental expert Craig Condi is not with us today. So, yeah, I was noticing that as you came up. I thought that was intriguing. So I'm not sure what to say. He would be the person to pose that question to. I'm not really sure what to say. Obviously, I mean, I'm inclined, just what little I know, to say that our environmental situation is not good, just because we have so many conservative Republicans. But maybe that's a not very diplomatic thing to say. But it's right. Well, though it is in Utah, we do have a nice strong tradition of concern for land use, for water use. I mean, there is a conservative in the sense of conservation-minded strain in Utah history and in Mormon history in particular. All of our concerns about stewardship of the land and so on. So there's certainly something that could be tapped into there, but I suspect that probably for political reasons, you know, certainly we're not recycling our garbage into our compost heaps. We do have recycling. We do have that now.
Does the government pick up the tab for that?
Yeah. Only in the city.
Only in Salt Lake City.
Only in Salt Lake City, I'm told.
How do they work? Do they come around and collect?
Yeah, you have your garbage bins, and then there's a blue bin for recycling, and so you push that out. And they did recently expand it, because for a long time it was quite limited, and now it's a lot more diverse in terms of what you can recycle. So I guess it's not hopeless. But Provo does not recycle.
Do they do it for businesses as well as residences?
Anyone know? Do they do it for businesses as well as for residences?
I don't know. I think on a pay basis. So
you have to pay to participate. Mm.
You know, Provo residents...
Demand is growing, and all you have to do is ask your... Just keep demanding it from your local officials. Yeah.
So I hope that everybody that had an interest sends in their survey. You know, at least that shifts the balance to those that go, I won't pay a penny and I won't sort. I don't know.
Right.
They're weighing how much it would cost, and if people would pay $3 or $5 more a month. So I think they're looking at it.
Yeah.
There's a very good advocate at BYU, but I think it's Roy Peterson.
I don't know.
Anyway, he's trying to get it started.
Well, it is. There is movement up at the U. A student group has just demanded recycling on campus again. It had been phased out, and also it's been expanded to include the county that covers Draper. Does anyone know what that is? What's that? Salt Lake, even in Draper, South Salt Lake County, Salt Lake. Oh, okay. Well, as far as some environmental problems that Utah faces, MagCorp produces the most air pollution in the country for one city. Yes, so MagCorp is our big problem. People have to park their cars in a lot elsewhere and get a shuttle in to work at MagCorp because otherwise the paint would just fall off of their cars. Yeah, it's a big, big problem. And we're concerned about the importation of nuclear waste and the incineration of biochemical weapons. So those are the three things that we have going on that are taking a lot of attention. Yeah.
This is just an observation that's
coming over
more than anything. I'm
reaching
from Tooele.
You're from Tooele. Do you want to talk in the mic?
Probably don't need to talk about the environment.
What is interesting is I'm originally from Tooele. I'm the former county chairman of the Republican Party from Utah County. The starter of the Oliver North Legal Defense Fund, he was my classmate in Annapolis.
This is why I don't sit down, so.
this is what a situation is the real reality in Utah. the people work for you regardless of their parties. And it's a situation of keeping their feet to the fire enough times. And I have found some interesting situations. My specialty in the military was nuclear weapons. And it's very interesting in conflicts, because most of your comments have been things that have been both my bread and butter and other situations, not that they would be my choice, they were my responsibilities. But in that process, I have found situations across party lines to be very effective. I was the national coordinator of the NIMX, and in that situation we were very successful. But we had to bring out four former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to meet with the First Presidency in the process. So the important thing is, you don't just abrogate, you keep your people their feet to the fire. The elected officials, regardless of parties, do that. And all you need to do is get the right combinations and use the Mormon perspective to do that. To start off with, get scripture quotes as much as anything. Not so much living prophets, but the dead ones are the best ones. Because they have 10 generations to accomplish. And the one that worked best at the Republican convention when they tried to shut us down on the MX was put off the armor of man and put on the armor of God. And we won. But it's just a situation. I may personify, quote unquote, the enemy, but the real reality is you have people who will stand for truth on all sides. And what you need to do is incorporate them collectively at the right times. As county chairman, my job was not to judge, but to conduct a symphony, to bring each one in at the right time, whether I viewed their perspective right or wrong. They contributed to a symphony. And you can either make beautiful music or a hell of a lot of noise. And use that effectively. I applaud what you're doing. I came here for the purpose, because this should be the hotbed. This should be the dignity of the individual, the frustration of the denial. Those are fundamental principles of the gospel, and we need to apply that. I am here myself. I had four tours of Nam, and I lost my toes to Agent Orange. Many of the people who you perceive as the opposition are in fact the ones that paid the price and want to be the allies. And so work collectively there. It was just so interesting that each situation that you spoke about was my background. and it was funny. And just the truth is what is important in the gospel and in its application. Let's find some things. If we can each make a commitment to bring three or four friends to, 29 August? My daughter's getting married the 30th, but I'll be there the 29th. What part of the U of U is it in?
It'll be at the Union Building. We meet in the lobby. That's usually where we gather. We have about 5 more minutes. Any final comments, questions? A question here, and then James, maybe to wrap up?
I've been touched by some of the comments from the audience and a sister that mentioned suffering on behalf of her beliefs and the one who lives in Provo, and I think it might be the only place worse than Davis County where I live. And I wondered if it'd be okay if I read a scripture. I read this scripture at my session that I did Thursday, and lightning did not strike at Sunstone, so I... because I feel, James, I think it was just a slip of language.